Will the joint committee please come to order? The House co-chair has graciously allowed me to chair this one again, and it's not my turn. Thank you. I particularly enjoy dealing with this commission, having served on it on and off, I think, since its inception. So we'll turn the podium over to you, Thias, as the current chair. And I will just start by saying that Stan Leiphart down there has for years been the spark plug behind a great deal of defense of a great deal of different interests, from allottees to industry groups to even occasionally environmental groups who were told they couldn't do something. It's just been amazing that the diversity that this commission has done in terms of counter-harassment of federal harassers of Alaska citizens. Amen. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to introduce, first of all, my name is Thias Schaub. I am the current chairman of the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. I was just elected to be chairman last fall, a little bit under coercion. I have with me here Steve Porter, who was the past chair for the last couple of years, and Stan Leiphart, who is the executive director of the commission and has been on the commission staff since it was formed in 1981. I also wanted to introduce the other members of the commission who are in the audience with us here today. We have Dale Ackles, if you want to, where'd you go? Dale was here.
Back there.
Charlie Bussell, if you either stand or wave your hand. Grant Doyle, Don Finney, behind me. Clarence Furbush is here. And we have also, well, Representative Ivan is on the commission. He's not here with us yet today. Steve Porter, who I just introduced. Senator Sharp is on our commission. Myself. Representative Beasy is not here yet, but hopefully he will be able to be with us. And, of course, yourself, Senator Halford, has been a member of the commission since the beginning. Is that what you...
I think close to that.
I was trying to remember.
I was an original member, Mr. Chairman. Although you don't know that, you're a new kid on the block.
I was appointed to the commission by Senator Tim Kelly when he was president of the Senate. So that was a while ago. I'm not quite sure how long. But I wanted to, before we get started, I give you just a brief overview, those of you that don't already know quite a bit about the Citizens Advisory Commission. It was formed in 1981, shortly after the passage of ANILCA. As most of you are aware, ANILCA put 104 million acres of land into federal conservation units and established specific requirements and restrictions on land use. And these major changes, what was going to be have a lot of effect on Alaskans and how they use the land. So the commission was formed basically to watch out over the interests of Alaskans and the citizens in access to the land and in implementation of ANILCA. Although some of the federal agencies that we've been dealing with for the last number of years may have felt at times that we have been a bit of a thorn in their side, and I guess at times that has been our role, to be a thorn in their side. We've developed a pretty good working relationship with agencies within the Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture, the two primary departments that we work with. As I said, our mission is primarily to protect the interests of Alaskans, to see that land management decisions are consistent with the law and that include the interests of the citizens of Alaska. The types of issues that we tackle and the people that we have assisted through the commission varies widely. And I wanted to give you just a couple of examples here, and then Stan's going to go into a little more detail in a little bit. We initiated a cooperative effort with agencies to simplify reporting requirements for air carriers operating on federal conservation system units so they can file one report rather than separate reports to a number of federal agencies. It's just an example of a streamlining type of activities that we engage in. This particular issue is still ongoing. We're still working at getting one report rather than four. We've assisted guides and hunters, private landowners, miners, loggers, commercial fishermen, Native organization on public access and regulatory issues. We've submitted comments on numerous land plans and proposed federal regulations such as the Congress Land Management Plan, Endangered Species Act proposed listings, RS 2477 regulations, and other regulatory issues regarding management of federal lands. When the commission was first established, there were five staff people. In addition to the 16 commission members, there were five full-time staff. The commission reviewed and commented on all the major land management documents for federal conservation units and assisted numerous groups and individuals with their problems in dealing with the federal government on management issues. The commission's now down to one staff person that kind of does it all. And so likewise, since we have fewer staff, we have at times had to pare down the number of issues that we tackle. I don't know if we actually have pared it down. Maybe we just divide our duties a little bit differently. We still handle a lot of issues, but we do only have one paid staff now. But although the commission is kind of a shadow of its former self as far as staff goes, it is still a very valuable resource for citizens and organizations who are seeking information, both current or historical information on federal land policies and actions in Alaska. Stan's the only staff person that I know in state government that checks the Federal Register every day, and he flags important issues that come up in Alaska in the Federal Register, and he has a wide variety or wide network of individuals and organizations that he, you know, pumps this information out to on a regular basis, and provides, you know, quite a resource as far as historical information and that sort of thing. Before you, I think all of you have a copy of the annual report that kind of details a lot of the activities that we've been involved in over the last year, and Stan's going to touch on some of those issues in just a few minutes. But before we hear from Stan, I've asked Steve Porter, who, as I said, was the past director or the chairman for the last 2 years, going to share with you some thoughts about the state's relationship with the federal government.
Mr. Chair, although I'm relatively new in the Citizens Advisory Commission, I've only participated for the last 5 or 6 years. Even in that short amount of time, there have been certain trends that became real apparent, and I'd like to kind of talk about those trends in our relationship to the federal government, between the state and the federal government. There are several areas that the federal government has influence over activities and uses of the people of the state of Alaska. And some are more public, like the Federal Register, and some of those we have more influence over than others. One of those areas where the federal government interacts and has impact on the state of Alaska is through the current administration, or actually any administration, president of the current administration, in negotiating international treaties and agreements. Over the years, the federal government has negotiated treaties and agreements, and they have had very specific impacts on the state of Alaska. One example of that was the International Treaty on Polar Bears that was negotiated several years ago. That specific treaty was used just even this last year by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as the authority for their regulatory authority over specific oil and gas operations on the North Slope. So, one thing we need to be aware of is that even international treaties can have an impact on the people of Alaska. One of the things that is really important is that the international agreements are generally negotiated in Washington, D.C. For example, there's an Alaska Arctic Offshore Oil and Gas Guidelines that is presently being negotiated between the various countries of the Arctic. That agreement is being negotiated in Washington, D.C. with very little or no input from the state of Alaska. The last time I looked, Alaska had the only Arctic waters in the United States. We were concerned about that. We feel like it should be important for the federal government to include the state of Alaska, and perhaps if you're going to meet on U.S. soil, they should meet in Alaska and basically allow the Alaska people to participate in that process, since they're the ones that are impacted. Other things, like say for example, the biosphere reserves that you're aware of, that Stan will talk about later, is another area where the international agreements can impact this. Another area that we're a lot more comfortable with is Congress. Congress, our representation there, they're protecting our rights and keeping us well informed, and we're not as concerned about that area. Another area is in the regulatory arena. This is one that really does have a substantial impact on us. Direct regulatory actions on the federal government. One of the things that Stan is able to do is, as Tobias mentioned, was reviewing the Federal Register on a regular basis and reviewing those regulations to see what kind of impact they have on the state. The thing that Stan really does for us is he'll review the regulations, but then he will send those regs out to the experts that understand that particular area. He's a coordinator also. So even though Stan is one individual, he doesn't have to review everything. He has the contacts throughout the state to be able to send the information out to them, ask them for their expertise, and then we as a commission can support the people that way. The other thing that's happening in the federal regulatory arena right now is a lot of times regulations will come out and they'll say we're making housekeeping changes. Now, the word housekeeping will show up, which would suggest that this is no big deal, they're just kind of cleaning them up. And what is happening in those housekeeping regulations, and Stan has some examples of those, is they're actually stepping forward and increasing the regulatory authority in those housekeeping regulations, and that's something else we've been monitoring and tracking. In addition to regulation, there's policies that change on a regular basis in the federal government. One of the most recent ones that has substantially impacted the people of the state is the interim policy that Secretary of Interior just changed on RS-2477. The concern we have is the policy that was originally written was a coordinated and extensive process between all the states in the state of Alaska. There was a substantial amount of review. The most recent policy was basically made a decision made in Washington, D.C. and implemented in the western states. We're uncomfortable with that also. We'd like to try to influence those types of operations so that type of thing doesn't happen. The federal government also does things called clarification of policy. Generally, we worry about that also. Stan tracks that as well as the rest of us. Example there that Stan will also talk about is the National Park Service navigability of water regulations. Once again, the federal government is not clarifying. They are stepping forward and taking more authority over the state of Alaska. And we're trying to understand that, understand the impacts to people, and coordinating a response so that we can basically protect the interests of the people of the state of Alaska. And one of the last areas I want to talk about this morning is studies. Studies seldom are truly studies. If somebody wants to conduct a study, it basically seems oftentimes there are some studies that are conducted for pure research and understanding. Most of the time, there's a predetermined goal set out in advance of the study that the study does nothing more than come to the conclusion that they intended originally. And what we have done over the past is we have looked at some of those studies, examined them closely, and on occasion have been able to see the intent of where the study was going and rebut or refute it. I'll use one example. I don't want to waste your time on this, but there was a study done by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the Colville Delta. The study's concern was helicopter impacts on birds. So, and the thesis was if there was oil and gas development in the Colville Delta, helicopter overflights may have the birds run around so much that they would lose sufficient weight so they couldn't fly south for the winter, and therefore they would die. Okay, you need to understand that they killed over 500 birds and weighed their muscles to make this determination, and they actually herded thousands of birds, up to 2 kilometers to capture them. And so the study's impacts were actually substantially greater than a 20-year, Prudhoe Bay type of activity in the Colville Delta. It couldn't have had as many impacts as the study itself had. And actually, the conclusion of the study after all this was that somehow they might just do that. But once we looked at their formulas also randomly doubled a couple of factors And once we submitted our response to that, the study suddenly disappeared. So it's those types of things we're trying to keep track of to make sure that, that the people of Alaska, the rights are preserved, and that the federal government can be held to a standard of truth and honesty. There's some suggestions, I think, of what needs to be done. In terms of international treaties, I've mentioned before, I think it's important that, that Alaskans are involved in these international treaty negotiations, and that if it's possible, and it is only affecting the state of Alaska, that that type of treaty negotiations happens in the state where the people can see it. Congress, we have good support there. I'm not as concerned about that area. I think we appreciate the legislature's support of Congress. You guys, we really appreciate your support of what you've done for our delegation. Regulations, we need to make it a priority to review all federal regulations and actions, and whether they're couched in housekeeping terms language or new regulatory action. And actually, there's a more active thing we can do on the policy types of events. One is to comment on the policy shifts. But the other thing is sometimes the state of Alaska can act on policy. You know, just because the federal government says this is our policy doesn't mean that we have to agree with it. If the state has a right, sometimes the state should act. For example, on RS-2477, I think it would be appropriate for the legislature to place a fund of money out there for enhancing an RS-2477. You have the right, you have the authority, and that may be one thing that the state can affirmatively protect the rights of their own people by moving forward. Allow the federal government to chase us and sue us. Instead of us trying to sue the federal government to push them back, we have rights, we've got to exercise them. That's all I have to say for the time.
Mr. Chairman, do you want to entertain questions now, or should we have Stan?
Let's go ahead and go to Stan, and then we can go to questions.
Stan, all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have a couple of items that maybe I would like to use as examples of issues that we've looked at in the last few months. A lot more detail in our annual report. I provided a couple of copies of different things that we've sent out in the last few months. One of the things that we've been noticing a lot of movement in and a lot of changes in recent months is the whole approach of the federal government, the whole posture of the federal government, if you will, towards navigable waters. In July of last year, the National Park Service adopted some of these clarification regulations, housekeeping regulations, that specifically stated that their management authority, their jurisdiction, extends to all waters within the unit of the national park system, including navigable waters. And our assessment, we worked with the AG's office, we worked with other state agencies and trying to get a handle on how this was going to affect state management priorities. One of the things we came up against was the fact that this flies in the face of the major piece of enabling legislation up here for most of the park units, and that's the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act, and that's ANILCA, which essentially says state lands are included. They're not subject to federal jurisdiction on a lot of issues. That's one instance just in the last 6 months where the so-called clarifying reg makes it very clear that the federal government has extended its authority in the state-owned waters. Coming on the heels of that last fall were some proposed, these are not final, the Park Service regulations are final, as a matter of fact, they originally proposed in 95, they're now final. In fall of last year, the BLM proposed similar regulations that have to do with the management of wild and scenic rivers and wild and scenic study rivers, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. There are six wild and scenic rivers in Alaska that are under BLM management. Interestingly enough, about four or five of those, some of the heaviest or the largest mining areas in the whole state, they ended up wild and scenic river status. What, again, characterized as housekeeping, sort of cleaning up the regulatory package, these BLM regulations, again, made it clear that under the Wild and Scenic River Act, BLM had the authority to essentially approve or disapprove of any water resource project that affected a segment of a wild and scenic river. And it didn't have to be directly within the designated corridor. It could be on any tributary of that corridor. And one of the things that they included on the list, recent addition, was as a water resource project was suction dredging. Now, those of you who are familiar with the 40-mile mining district, the 40-mile wild and scenic river, that's a pretty lucrative operation over there, or a series of operations in the 40-mile. And inclusion of suction dredging as a water resource project under these regulations as proposed would essentially allow the BLM to say, even on state mining claims, even on state navigable waters, you cannot conduct this operation. So, again, we found that was one area that where the federal government, again, is extending its jurisdiction and authority into state-owned waters. Also included, just as a side note, as a water resource project were things like fisheries enhancement projects. So if you had any sort of fishery enhancement project or habitat restoration project, again, this is a management prerogative of the state, that would be subject to approval or disapproval by the BLM. Another set of regulations, once again, this sounds like a broken drum, but housekeeping regulations, are the so-called BLM law enforcement regulations, criminal law enforcement regulations. These are still under review. I've prepared an analysis, and I've placed a copy of that analysis on the table for each of you. And these don't just affect Alaska. They affect, of course, all the western public land states who are the BLM lands. But there's some particular concerns for Alaska because, as we find pretty frequently with the federal agencies that have a more national scope, and they tend to ignore some of the special provisions that Alaska was granted under the Alaska Lands Act, and this is certainly one instance where that's the case. A large part of these regulations are housekeeping. They've renumbered sections, they've reformatted them, they've made really no substantive changes, but they've slipped a few little tidbits in there that if you don't catch them and they become final, you find yourself again with language and regulation that says BLM has management authority even on navigable waters within the state of Alaska. Again, I think if we look at FLTMA, which is for the Organic Act, the Federal Policy and Management Act for the BLM, if you look at their authorities under that law, if you look at their authorities under ANILCA, they don't have the authority to go off the federal public lands and exercise their management jurisdiction. So if you have some time, take a look at that analysis. I think you'll find it enlightening how so-called housekeeping regs can really have a major effect. I don't want to get into too much detail on some of this other stuff. The commission has been pretty heavily involved over the years with RS-2477. It's one of the first things that I heard when I walked into the door in 1982. They were doing the management plan for Thirst Creek, Wild and Scenic River, was RS-2477. And even a lot of the people in the federal agencies didn't know what those were at that time. And I know these two committees have had a hearing on that in the last couple of weeks, and we've provided some testimony at that, so I won't go into any more detail on that. One of the pieces of legislation that hasn't had a great deal of effect in Alaska as until recently is the Endangered Species Act. You know, we're all probably aware of this up in the Pacific Northwest with the spotted owl. There are a number of species in Alaska that are listed, primarily marine mammals. However, the Stellar Sea Lion, which was listed about 3 or 4 years ago, was listed initially as threatened throughout the range in Alaska, and now listed as threatened in the eastern part of Alaska, and the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands is listed as endangered. That listing and the designation of critical habitat for that species has had a major impact on the bottom fish industry in the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands area. I mean, there are extensive regulatory changes that have taken place, and I don't know the details of all of them, but a lot of things have been changed with that industry because of the classification of the Stellar Sea Lion. We have right now under public review, so-called status review by the Fish and Wildlife Service, two species here in southeastern Alaska, so-called Alexander Archipelago wolf, which a lot of people believe is simply a common gray wolf, doesn't really meet the criteria for a separate subspecies, and the Queen Charlotte goshawk, which both of whom the petition was received by the Fish and Wildlife Service about 2 or 3 years ago to list both of these animals as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, based on the data that the Fish and Wildlife Service had, data that was provided by the U.S. Forest Service and the State Department of Fish and Game. They made the determination that listing wasn't warranted. The petitioners filed suit. We're back in the mode of doing another status review. Essentially the same data. I guess there's a little more data on the wolf. But that's a good example, I think, of how the Endangered Species Act is frequently used as a political tool rather than a biological or a management tool. And I think we're going to see more instances in Alaska where the Endangered Species Act is going to have a major impact on resource development and just general use in the state. Right now there are some 15 birds, mammals, and fishes in Alaska that are on the list of so-called species of concern. So these are animals that have the same status as the wolf and the goshawk, which at some point we may see petitions to list those. So, and those cover not only southeastern Alaska, but western Alaska and in some cases even the interior. Another area where we're just now kind of breaking a little bit of ground, so to speak, we're just kind of educating ourselves as a commission, and certainly as a staff, is the whole area of international area designations. Things like Man in the Biosphere Reserve Program under the United Nations, World Heritage Site designations under the United Nations. Those things have gotten a lot of attention. I know there's a HJR 14 is now in the legislature under consideration to support Congressman Jones' bill, the American Land Sovereignty Protection Act. But right now, in Alaska itself, there are 4 biosphere reserves and 2 World Heritage sites, and there's an additional 7 areas in Alaska that have been nominated for inclusion on the World Heritage Site list. And I really don't know enough about the mechanism of how those things are managed to say how or how they do or don't affect the management authority of the federal agencies. But let me give you an example. If you talk to the National Park Service, for instance, about Glacier Bay, which is both a biosphere reserve and a World Heritage Site, they will tell you that that doesn't have an effect on how they manage the park. However, in recent meetings that I've been involved with the National Park Service on Glacier Bay and commercial fishing in Glacier Bay, one of the first things that gets put onto the table that has to be considered is the fact that this area is designated as a biosphere reserve and a World Heritage Site. So it's a bit schizophrenic. On one hand, they insist that it has no major effect, and on the other hand, they say we have to manage to protect that designation. Yellowstone National Park is another good example. It's a World Heritage Site, I think, and also a biosphere reserve. I don't know the name of the large mine that was never allowed to open because the pressure that was brought, not just on the National Park Service, but on the President's office to oppose opening that mine because of the argument that it would jeopardize this world's internationally designated site. So I guess I bring this up, just I know you're all aware of it, but And we're not educated enough. We're going to talk about it tonight at our meeting. I have a lot of background material for that, but that's something that, as Steve mentioned, these are decisions that don't get made locally. And these are decisions that have the potential to affect a lot of people here in Alaska. Just a couple of other things that maybe I'll give you a heads up on, things that are on the radar screen, so to speak, is the fact that the federal agencies started writing their management plans mandated by the ANILCA in early 1980s. Well, all those plans, 10, 12, in some cases 15 years old. So what we're about to see, I think, within the next 4 to 5 years is a whole other round of planning activity for the National Parks and National Wildlife Division in Alaska. And there were, I think, a lot of lessons learned during those first planning activities, but it's just, there's going to be a lot more pressure, I think, brought to bear in the agencies by national groups to really ratchet down on some of these promises that were made to Alaskans in ANILCA, and that things like motorized access into wilderness areas. That doesn't happen anywhere else in the country. And I think there should be a lot of pressure brought to bear on the federal agencies to try to restrict that type of activity as much as possible. We've already seen it last year when the National Park Service adopted a vessel management plan, which closed large areas of Glacier Bay to motorized vessels. And the major reason given is wilderness and recreational value. Not safety, not resource damage, but wilderness and recreational values. So that's one thing that's, I think we're going to all have to watch in the years to come. We're going to have a whole other round of planning activity. Maybe I'll wrap this thing up. Our annual report is there. It's got a bit more detail on the things I brought up. Anything that you see on the list of stuff that you have that you want more information on, let me know. I'll be happy to provide it. A lot of people think the world runs on oil. I sometimes think it runs on paper. And I've got plenty of paper to provide if you're interested. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll wrap it up.
I just want to add one comment. At our last meeting, we had a discussion with the federal bureaucrats over Glacier Bay. And it's absolutely amazing that these people are attacking the 25 or 30 fishing vessels that traditionally fish in Glacier Bay on behalf of increasing the number of 800 and 900 foot cruise ships. And somehow they think that's an environmental issue. It doesn't make any sense. They have a constituency that is not just environmental. It's a very different constituency, and the wrongheadedness of their arguments is so obvious in issues like that. You know, kick out the small fishermen, the subsistence fishermen, the Alaska residents, so you can vastly increase the traffic by 20,000 ton cruise ships. Doesn't make sense. Representative Barnes?
Mr. Chairman, I think for the committee members that haven't learned yet about biospheric reserves, they should certainly learn, because, and it will be coming your way because we do have a resolution in the House, that anywhere you have one of these designations is just not the designation of that park for 250 miles around it as well, which means no human activity would take place.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
go ahead.
I think they'll probably have guys in blue helmets and black helicopters enforcing it too. At least there's, though, some of my constituents would certainly think so.
It's just a question to Stan. Where are the current, are all the current biosphere reserves existing federal parks?
No,
I think they are, but
not.
Okay, what's the...
There are, for example, the Aleutian Islands, I believe, is designated or nominated for World Heritage Site designation. I'm not sure the difference between the two. They're sort of like Mutt and Jeff or Abbott and Costello. They kind of come together. as a pair, but Aleutian Islands, I think the Arctic Refuge, wildlife rescue, but primarily parks and refuges.
Are there questions by members of the committee? And believe me, this commission really is a resource, and Stan is a resource on any of the things that you're kind of hearing a piece of. He probably has a lot more background on it than you can listen to in a short meeting.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in state affairs, we've been kind of reviewing some of the boards and commissions that exist across the state, and I would be delighted to hear from you as to the current status of your appointments, how many members you have whose appointments have not been reappointed, if you still have enough actively appointed members to form a quorum when it's time to do business, and you don't need to give me all that information here unless you choose. I'd be curious to know if you know how many of your members have terms that have expired.
We have, the way the commission is set up, if they aren't reappointed, mm-hmm. they automatically continue until they are reappointed. We have four commission members who are appointed by the Senate, which includes two senators, mm-hmm. and we have four commission members who are appointed by the House, including two House members, and eight who are appointed by the governor. And some of their terms have sort of expired, but they have not been replaced, so they continue on the commission. So, yes, we do have enough people to continue with as far as a quorum. Our meeting tonight, we have well beyond what we need for a quorum. And by the way, our meeting tonight is at 6 o'clock at Centennial Hall, and any of you would be who are interested in hearing more about some of these issues in greater detail would certainly be welcome to join us.
We can follow up. If you have any information you'd like to give to Senate State Affairs, I'd be pleased to hear it just to make it part of our file. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just for the members that don't know it, the commission is traditionally deleted from the budget by the governor's office and reinserted in the budget by the legislative branch. And they have done a very good job in representing Alaskans in federal questions. Senator Lincoln.
Thank you. I've got three quick questions. I appreciate the information that you supplied, and I haven't had an opportunity to really review all of it, but it seems to be well written. And I appreciate you providing us with the information. One is in looking at your annual report, you state in here that although the commission's role is advisory, you can request the attorney general to file suit against a federal agency or official of the commission. Have you requested the AG to file any suits in 96?
Senator, no, not recently. And quite some time ago, actually, I think in 1987, we asked then-Governor Cooper to file a lawsuit against the National Park Service over its cabin regulations. Mm-hmm. I think in years past, we asked for lawsuits over Glacier Bay, and those have never... We actually did file, the state did file a lawsuit against the National Park Service over its cabin regulations. Unfortunately, we lost, but that's the one
thank you. And the other question that I've got is I noted in here your commission activities that the commission is no longer able to sponsor public meetings solely for gathering public input on specific issues, and that is bothersome to me, that if the general public, I know that you go on to say that you have that it's open for public comment when you have meetings, but I'm thinking about all of the folks that are in the outlying areas not having access to your meetings to be able to communicate to you and to testify, and that's a bit bothersome to me if the public is not having adequate input into the process.
One of the things we do as a commission is what we might call influencing the regulators. We can, even though we don't have the budget at this point to hold our own meetings, which we used to do historically, what we do now as a method of trying to allow the public to comment is what you might call psychological influence over the regulators. We demand certain things, and we bring them before the commission and ask them why they didn't have a public meeting. And, you know, such and such community. So we basically intimidate them into basically allowing the public to speak. And that's one of the things that we still can do is we actually ask for certain agencies to come before the commission and they show up. Deborah Williams showed up at her last meeting from the Department of Interior. And we asked her a substantial number of questions about navigable waters. And one of the things she agreed to was to sit down with the state and participate in making the determinations on several issues around navigable waters. So that's the only way we still have influence, and we try to do that.
Well, and I just want it noted, though, that for the commission that, you know, that not to have the public input is
we have public, anytime we have a meeting, there's public, they can, we have
I understand that.
We haven't been able to have the hearings like we used to go out and actually hold a hearing.
And that's exactly what I mean, though, is that if you're holding your hearings in Anchorage or in Fairbanks, then those are the folks that get to testify, and then you don't get those that are living in the outlying area. The other question that I've got is I think you distributed this letter of December 4th Stan, I believe you wrote, and there were a lot of really excellent points in here. I note that it did go to BLM and to all of the congressional delegation, the governor, and some of the other folks. I'd be interested to see what response you got from this letter, because there were some excellent points that you made.
Mr. Chairman, no response, really, but that's not untypical. This was in response to a proposed set of regulations. Published in the Federal Register, you can go through the Administrative Procedures Act, public comment. The response will be in the printed version of the final regulations if and when they appear in the Federal Register. Typically what they will do will list the groups or organizations that may have commented on a draft set of regulations and then either summarize it or in some cases reproduce the comments that we received. Had this been an environmental impact statement, the final environmental impact statement would have had a copy of this letter with perhaps any number of responses noted. These were the Wild and Scenic River rigs. But there is there's very seldom, I've known of only one or two instances where we've commented on a set of proposed regulations where we got a separate letter back to the commission. But that's not uncommon.
Representative Bowden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you folks looked into the proposed regulations about trapping on fish and wildlife on federal wildlife preserves, I'm not using the right terminology here. There was recent request for public comment and whatnot.
Mr. Chairman, that's one of those areas where I got copies and sent it to the world. I sent it to the Trappers Association and some trappers that I know personally. I talked to Fish and Game. Wasn't regulated. It was language in an appropriation bill that said something to the effect use of leg hole traps in wildlife refuges isn't prohibited, but we want the Fish and Wildlife Service to look at it. My concern was that they were supposed to put together a task force or a working group. They, for lack of a better word, fooled around for 90 days, then issued a notice saying, well, we don't have time to do this in the time we're given, so we just throw it out to comment for the general public, which certainly we support comment by the general public, but they didn't meet the requirements of the appropriation language, which is to put together a task force. So but we have looked at those.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I feel it's certainly an important part of the economy. A lot of rural Alaskans, to mention the fact that we have further restrictions on predator intensive management situations in our state. So if any changes, I would appreciate knowing about it if there's any new developments or whatever, and I appreciate your efforts in that.
Sure, maybe I could follow up on that. One of the arguments, and I think sort of this is a very legitimate argument and supported by statute, is that all activities on the wildlife refuge are subject to compatibility determination. The ANILCA, which established most of the refuges up here and expanded or renamed the rest of them, while it doesn't specifically authorize trapping, it makes it very clear both in its intent language and in the general authority language in it that that's a traditional activity and it will be allowed. It's been, they've made compatibility determinations on all the refuges, I believe, except maybe the Alaska Maritime Refuge, that trapping is an acceptable and allowed activity. So, not to sound like a Pollyanna, I don't think we have to worry in the immediate future that trapping is jeopardized on the refuges in Alaska, but certainly something that we will watch.
Sure. The thing that we were concerned about on the way in which that was done was there was an appropriation for a study. Okay. The problem with that was what we mentioned before. Study this particular type of leg hole trap, which basically was a flat gust to say they're going to study it, they're going to try, take that out of process. So what we did is we contacted all the trappers associations here in Alaska. We also made contact with the trappers associations in Lower 48 because it was nationwide in an effort to allow the trappers to be able to comment and let them know what's going on. But it was through the study that ultimately we expect to see regulations and a determination that says this is not proper. And that's the concern we mentioned earlier. We'll try to track that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to mention one other thing. A number of the issues that we work on are specific to Alaska, and some of them are actually more general and apply to other Western states as well. There's a number of members of the legislature who've been becoming quite active in an organization called the Western States Coalition. I have gone to a number of those meetings and a number of the other commissioners have. We've been recently talking about, in fact, myself and a couple of the other legislators about perhaps getting, you know, Stan or a couple of the other commission members to go to these meetings with the other Western states to talk about a lot of these areas of common interest, like, you know, the BLM enforcement regs are, you know, a good example. That's something that's applying to all of the Western states. Stan really is a wonderful source of information, and I think sometimes we forget about that we should, you know, share him a little bit with some of the rest, at least to the information he has access to and that we've put together on some of these things with the other Western states. And I know a number of you here have been involved with that group. And their next meeting is going to be in July, I think, in Spokane, Washington. I'm hoping that if we still exist as a commission, we'll try to get Stan down to that meeting.
Senator Taylor.
I haven't had a chance to read all of this yet, but I had seen pieces and parts of it earlier. People had sent them to me. But Stan, you provided us with a copy of proposed regulations, law enforcement criminal on BLM lands. And I find some of this very frightening. In particular, if I look at page 2, Now, these, let me ask first, has FLPMA, FLMPA, has that become law? Yeah, that is a law. And these are regulations being proposed to carry out that law. Is that right?
Not just FLMPA. The FLMPA is sort of the Organic Act of the BLM. It's their general authority. But actually, there's a lot of other statutes.
Well, you also cited the Sykes Act, which has also been passed. I guess what I was concerned about is it says it's in the law, and then the regulation basically just cites the law on some of these proposals, which fly directly in the face of the Bill of Rights and due process. And the easiest way I can explain it is to draw your attention to the committee to page 2 at the bottom, the underlined, where they're talking about the federal government contracting with local enforcement officials. In the performance of their duties and under such contracts, such officials and their agents are authorized to carry firearms, execute and serve any warrant or other process issued by a court or officer of competent jurisdiction. That could be one of their officers. Same with the new regulation. Then it says make arrests without warrant or process for a misdemeanor he has reasonable grounds to believe being committed in his presence or view, or for a felony he has reasonable grounds to believe that the person to be arrested has committed or is committing such a felony. That, here's the part that draws my attention, because that's fairly standard language I've just read to you. Search without warrant or process any person, place, or conveyance according to any federal law or rule of law, and seize without warrant or process any evidentiary item as provided by federal law. Then goes on to say, while exercising the powers and authorities provided by such contract pursuant to this section, such law enforcement officials and their agents shall have all of the immunities of federal law enforcement officials. I can't imagine anything that would chill the hearts of Alaskans more than realizing that the federal government could contract with whoever they desired, who would then be carrying some sort of little badge and show up at your cabin or your house or whatever and decide to search your person and your possessions and do so without a warrant and do so without any process whatsoever. And then it goes on to provide extensive penalties should you resist. I just find that very frightening. Now, those regulations you said have not yet been enacted.
No, Senator. They're still under public review.
What's the comment deadline? The
comment deadline is March the 7th, which is a week from tomorrow, I think.
But the mafia will get rid of those pesky cabin sites.
That's very frightening. We have sent something in, I assume, through your body, saying that you are concerned about those?
Not yet, but it will be by today.
Okay.
The commission meeting tonight will decide
on the Senator Taylor.
Yeah. Following along with those proposed rules, it tells us specifically what we may do as Alaskans on BLM lands, which, by the way, is a huge portion of Alaska. I usually focus on U.S. Forest Service land in my district, but BLM is very big in the rest of the state. And one of the rules generally prohibits draining or dumping of sewage or solid waste except in designated places or receptacles. I'm not quite sure how you camp on BLM land.
You, I won't
don't
go
ask.
There.
Literally.
Don't ask.
They then go on to explain whether or not I may, apparently I can't yell in the woods anymore either. My friend or child is away from the campsite and I yell, I'm creating a disturbance on public lands, and this very same Nazi-like officer, I guess, can come visit me and cite me. I sincerely hope you will react strongly to these proposed regulations, but if in fact they're already in law and all they're doing is revisiting some of these phrases, I guess I'm just very hopeful you people will be able to continue to keep us abreast, and maybe even the Attorney General, who might be convinced to litigate some of these questions. I think they're very serious.
Representative Ogun?
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if that can't create a disturbance if discharging in a firearm would be considered a disturbance as well.
Oh, yes. It's right there, page 7.
Mm-hmm. Page 7.
Mr. Chairman, maybe one thing I'd like to point out in this, as we're finding out in these so-called housekeeping regs, the original regulations, and I put those in parentheses after the bold there under each section, I think it makes it very specific that those regulations about discharging firearms apply to developed campgrounds, and this revised regulations are very, they're silent on that. They give the impression that it's anywhere, at least the way they're written, not written very well. So the originals said, developed areas and new regulations just say in BLM areas. Well, that could be construed to be the White Mountains National Recreation Area, a couple million acres. They need to refine a lot of the language in here.
Mr. Chairman, another point if I may.
Representative Ogden.
I certainly share the Senator from Wrangell's concern, especially our due process rights. And, it's just unthinkable to me that they can do searches without warrants or process any person, place, or conveyance. I wonder if these fellows take an oath to defend the Constitution. If they do, how seriously they take it. It's very scary.
We have a member of the commission. Go ahead. You need to stand and identify yourself so it's on the table.
I'm a member of the commission.
Thank you.
One of the things that is very, very concerning to me is that there is a provision in these new statutes that were proposed and published in the National Register, which they then enforced, that allows the BLM to commandeer local law enforcement to fulfill these regulations. So they understand that there's going to be a lot of resistance. So what they've done is they've made it so they can use our own police to enforce the regulations and do it without warrants.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to sleep better tonight.
Yeah. Further questions?
Being sarcastic.
Just so I guess I'll ask this question. If we were able to allocate some financial resources in some kind of priority order to some of the areas where we're losing ground to the federal government, i.e. RS-2477s, navigable waters, regulatory takings, whatever it might be, how would the commission suggest we prioritize those allocations? And if, you don't have to respond now, but that's something we should take up with the commission so that now maybe the commission should come back to the legislature with a proposal for action that is specific enough that it can be appropriation items and budget items that are, you know, do something. Assert the RS-2477s. Push on Department of Law, quiet title on navigable waters, or whatever the issues are and the ways are to push each of the individual ones. Because we are under attack in numerous places, and we need to prioritize our defense.
That's a good idea. We'll definitely talk about that tonight at the meeting. And you will be there, is it right?
I will. Senator Taylor.
Just one other thing hit me here. Section 926543, bottom of page 9, asks the questions, if subsistence use of fish and wildlife resources is regulated by BLM and other federal land management agencies, and the answer is that the management of those resources on BLM lands is subject to the regulations at 50 CFR Part 100. Those are current, and do they also encompass concepts, enforcement concepts similar to those which Mr. Doyle mentioned or that I was making reference to in the proposed regs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, those are current regulations. Those are the Department of the Interior portions of the federal subsistence regs. There's actually a couple of different parts within that 50 CFR Part 100. There, I think the parts what we call A and B, which are the basic programmatic regs, which set up the federal subsistence management program. Then there are parts, I believe, C and D, and this is off the top of my head, I think, which are the actual seasons and bag limits. And of course, those change every year, or potentially can change every year, just as our state season and bag limits change. I'm not sure, frankly, right off the top of my head, if these regulations specify additional or different enforcement authorities beyond what the federal agencies already have under other regulations. But those are definitely current regulations.
Okay, so BLM becomes the police officers for enforcing subsistence regulations on BLM land. Is that what this says?
This is federal subsistence regulations.
Right, well, it's the only ones we've got are federal, basically.
Well,
yeah. We have our own state. Yes. We call them personal use units. the reason I'm asking that is because apparently the Forest Service then must be the enforcement officers on the U.S. Forest Service lands.
That's correct.
And it's come to my attention that there is a significant duality or duplicity in the manner in which those regulations are currently being enforced. They're being very strictly enforced on the Stikine River. I'm aware of that because it's in my backyard. So I know that they are being enforced by armed U.S. Forest Service enforcement personnel who check to see if you do qualify as a qualified subsistence person in that area. If you're from Ketchikan or Juneau or someplace else, you'll be arrested if you're in that area trying to hunt by those people. But I'm also aware that BLM is not enforcing their regulations in a similar fashion up north, because I have been up north and have watched people from Anchorage and Fairbanks come in and participate in subsistence activities in those communities, particularly caribou hunts, which they would literally be poachers on if they were enforcing the law as it is written. And I'm very concerned about that, especially when in my district right now, the new proposed subsistence regulations being proposed to the Federal Subsistence Board are that no one from Ketchikan will be allowed to hunt on Prince of Wales Island for deer. And that's causing a lot of consternation in my district. I guess I'm just concerned about that, and I wanted to raise that to your attention, that if in fact these are being enforced, and if they are being enforced with some level of uniformity, I guess I can't complain about it if they're going to do it regularly for all peoples of the state. But for some reason they choose to discriminate in the manner in which they enforce their own regulations, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention. Hopefully it's something you'll have a chance to discuss.
Further questions or comments? Senator Lehman.
Thank you, Chairman. Stan, I think this one is to you. On page 11 down at the bottom, one of the questions is, what BLM rules must I follow while I'm in an outstanding natural area? And then go on to say that term, outstanding natural area, is not found in the existing regulations. Where is it found? And what are you, what is it referring to if it's not found in the existing regulations?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm not sure.
So, but you wrote that question, did you not?
No, sir. I just repeat the questions. I'm going to back up a little bit. These regulations are written in what the BLM is calling its user-friendly format, which they're in the question and answer format.
Okay.
So the questions in bold, preceded by the section 9268.10, are the actual question, the regulatory question that is being asked. So that is their question.
Okay, so you don't know what that term means. I don't know what that term means. Does anybody know what it means? In the okay.
It's just referred to in that regulation.
And nowhere else.
And interestingly enough, like I say, it's not, I don't think it's defined in the in the section of the proposed regulation that addresses definitions of term. I didn't locate the term outstanding natural area in FLTMA or any of the other statutes that I reviewed, so I guess I'm as mystified as you are, Jeff, what that might mean.
Other questions? If we have no further questions, and thank you very much for your presentation and for your past efforts and for your ongoing efforts, and we'll do our best to keep them going.
Thank you.
That is the subject matter for our joint hearing. If the Senate members can stay for just a few minutes, we have a resolution I'd like to send on its way. But the joint committee is adjourned, and the Senate Resources Committee is in recess. Mr. Chairman, 477 resolution. We can move it. Everybody's just here.
Same thing. I went back and testified on last year.
Gunfight, right?
And we
Senator Taylor. Will the Senate Resources Committee please come back to order? We're just going to take up SJR 13, which is before us as a resolution previously heard. Previously scheduled, and it was in your packets for today. It deals with RS 2477s. It's fairly self-explanatory. The issue has certainly been before us numerous times in the past. It encourages actions by Congress to protect RS 2477s and action by the administration to implement a proactive and aggressive program to assert the state's ownership of RS 2477 rights away. I don't think we have anybody signed up to testify, do we? No. Okay. If there's no one to testify and there are no questions, what are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move SJR 13 out of the committee with individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Without objection, Senate Joint Resolution 13 is moved from committee with individual recommendations. And thank you. We have nothing more to come before the committee, so we are adjourned. Thank you.
Very good.